Welcome to Act 3, the podcast where we explore how to thoughtfully shape the rest of our lives. I'm your host, Kara Gray. This podcast is sponsored by Good Morning Freedom, my retirement coaching service where I help executives and professionals plan their Act 3. For more information, stay tuned until the end. Today, I welcome Joan Rosenthal to the podcast. Joan is a longtime board member of several New York City nonprofit organizations focused on changing the lives of children and families through education and related programs and services. Joan actively serves as treasurer of Bronx Works, the major settlement house of the South Bronx, and is a member of their development committee. Joan also is the president of WellMet Philanthropy, a women's giving circle identifying and funding nascent organizations and leaders working in and with underserved communities within the five boroughs of New York City. Joan is vice chair of Workforce Professionals Training Institute, WPTI, is a leader in developing job training and application programs serving nonprofits and their clients both virtually and in person, enabling people to find dignified work to support themselves and their families. Joan was a CPA by training, working for a number of years at Ernst & Young. She joined Chemical Bank as their accounting policy specialist and retired early as a managing director at JPMorgan Chase, after rising through the ranks of controller and chief financial officer's departments over the course of a 20-odd year career. Joan received a BS in accounting from the University of Albany and attended Hunter College High School. She is a lifelong New Yorker and lives there with her husband, Frederick Schiff. Welcome, Joan, to the podcast.
Thank you.
It says you're retired, but hardly. I mean, you are still very, very active and you have so much to tell my audience today. And I'm just really excited for this interview. I always start at the beginning of your main career when I do these interviews. And so tell me about joining Arthur Young, as it was called at that time, and about the demographics of the cohort you were part of.
Oh, gosh. So I am a product of the public schools here in New York City. And that's a theme, really, when we get to, my current life, my Act 3, if you will. I'm grateful for that. I went to State University. The University at Albany is part of the State University of New York system. There are four big universities and lots of, smaller colleges. And so that's where I was. We had two very snowy winters and two not so very snowy winters. And we used to have small people warnings. Because we had very tall buildings and then very short buildings on campus. That was very strange to me, coming from New York City, which, of course, has a lot of tall buildings. And so it always has a lot of wind. And I'm talking to someone who's in Chicago. So
yes.
We probably both think this is a little odd, but that's what it was. And so at the age of 21, I was out of college. And through an interview process, I interviewed with several of what were then the Big Eight accounting firms. Yeah. And as you and I talked about a little bit, this was the first year in the history of these firms and of many other businesses in the United States that they had a significant cohort of women. It's like a class each year they bring in public accounting, a number of young people at the same time to train them and, work them to death. I mean, that's what happens when you're a junior. And that particular year, my class at Arthur Young was 1/3 women. And it turned out that you could be ranked in one of three ways when you got your merit review. You could be 01, which was outstanding. 02 was very good. 03 was good, satisfactory, fine. The interesting thing is at the end of that first year, I've never forgotten this, there were no women, I repeat, no women in 03. Nobody thought they could be good / satisfactory. It wasn't that kind of a world. We all thought we had to excel. Wow. And the rest was obviously a combination of personal qualities and the jobs you were given and all sorts of other stuff like that. But nobody thought that we could be, I'll use a different word, ordinary. So that was the world in 1976. It was also the bicentennial, but that was less important than striving for, sort of a place in this new world where there were, frankly, not so many senior women.
Yeah,
I have since made a friend through my nonprofit work who's a few years older than I. And she tells me that when she went to Harvard Business School, And she graduated in 1970, so a little bit before I went to college and everything. There were something like 750 students that year at Harvard in the business school, and there were seven women.
Wow.
So, you know, that's a few years earlier than me. So she was more of the pioneer, but that gives you a sense. So it was really very interesting times. And I worked on actually aviation clients and people who actually ran factories. And so I once did an inventory and some of the young women, and by then I was, you know, I was a manager, a supervisor, came in like sandals with heels, you know, to walk through this factory that made the tanks that we eventually used in the Gulf War. And, you know, I just really couldn't make sense of that either. So, you know, it was a period, obviously, where everybody was trying, women were trying to figure things out. I think the men thought that they knew what was going on. You know, so it was very interesting. I will tell one other story that I've just told my daughter-in-law, which is that very early in my years at Arthur Young, I was doing audit work in the accounting department of what was then a very large garment center company that they had. You know, they had a number of brands, and I thought that was very cool because I knew the brands. There was a man who was a very good supervisor, and actually he was very nice to me. But one day on my desk, there was a note that said Kinderküche, children, cake, and church, not quite in that order, but yeah. And the next week there was a cartoon that said women belong in the kitchen barefoot and pregnant. And, you know, you didn't want to make waves in those days. But I thought this had to, you know, sort of go up the ranks, if you will, to my supervisors, because obviously there was a problem, obviously. And it turned out it was this gentleman who was an immigrant from Latin America. You know, the country and stuff like that isn't important. But this was just culturally to see a girl, and I was a girl, I was 23. So he had daughters who were almost the same age, and it just was, you know, kind of offensive to him. He didn't have anything against me personally. We got along, but the idea that somebody 23 could be, you know, auditing his work, was not sitting that well, clearly. And so the partner in charge of the account, who of course was a man, had to kind of go to the client and say, you know, like, this is unacceptable. And I'm, you know, I never talked to him about it. Of course, you know, when you're a very junior person, you don't get to see the partners and the leaders very much.
Right.
So I really don't, I mean, he was a decent guy, but I don't really know what he thought, but I just can't imagine that he was very happy about having to do that. But it was the beginning of, you know, all these sort of transitions that our society has gone through on a number of issues, women in the workplace being, you know, one, but not the only one. So, you know, I don't think that could happen today. It doesn't mean that people might not think it, but I think that the overt nature of that is probably something that, you know, doesn't happen nearly as much as it did in those days. So, you know, it was all learning, sort of being out there in the world. And on the other side of the coin, you know, it was also a big deal what you wore to work, which every day is what I call full regalia. I think everybody will.
Okay. Describe the full regalia.
Pumps, stockings, skirt suit, sometimes a pantsuit, but mostly skirt suit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Later on, when I had a little bit more money, you know, some tasteful jewelry. I love brooches, scarves. I'm a scarf lady. I told you last time I was a bag lady, but nobody got to see that as much. You know, it would be stuck in a desk drawer. Yeah. Along with my, you know, later on, my multiple pairs of pumps in 3D flavors. But yeah, you know, I mean,
my husband regalia.
What a suit. And I was telling the sales guys who were kind of hanging around that, you know, this is what we, you know, this is like our old life. He's buying a suit, you know, with a white shirt. This is, you know, he wore that every day to work. And I wore, you know, my equivalent. That's what people did. And it was important how you looked, how you presented yourself. All of these things were, you know, you were kind of scrutinized for that. And I don't think that's totally gone away today, but I hope for younger women, it's a lot better, frankly.
Yeah. And oftentimes you were the only woman in the room.
Oh, absolutely.
As well.
I mentioned to you when we chatted before, I have a friend who is, you know, a senior marketing executive. And she was telling me that I think probably this week she was going off to a board meeting and she was expecting to be the only woman in a room with 16 men.
Yeah.
So we're not done.
No, we're not done. Still happening. But it does give, like your stories do give some perspective on how far we've come, certainly. So yeah. I have hope, Joan.
I have hope all the time. And I hope that, you know, some of the programs that I push for, which are aimed at women, aimed in one of my organizations at the what I call the heads of household, the mostly single parents who are trying to raise kids in very, very difficult, systemically challenged circumstances, I would say, and, you know, in some of the bad neighborhoods and underserved areas in New York, you know, mostly they're women.
Yeah.
You know, no women's health. I mean, all of these kinds of things that have developed in my lifetime, you know, there's a lot more work to do in those areas too, not just, you know, not just the job front.
Yeah.
But, you know, yes, we have made a difference though. In the meantime, gotta keep plugging.
Yes. So, when you were around 50, you told me you were offered a package you couldn't refuse.
It was huge.
Tell me about that.
It was smart of me to take it. And then what happened was my husband pointed, and it was a very difficult time. It was, you know, the years right after the war against Saddam Hussein. We've had two Gulf Wars, so I don't like to say the Gulf War because then you don't know which one.
Yeah.
But, you know, we pulled down the statue of Saddam Hussein and all of this kind of stuff. And then there was a contraction in the financial services industry, I think nationwide, but certainly in New York. I have read that anywhere, depending on who you read, anywhere from 40 to 70,000 jobs were, you know, just poofed away, you know, to save money and that kind of thing. And these contractions happen in banking, just like reorganizations. Yeah. And so the thing that was interesting is my husband, who's a really good guy, kind of pointed out to me that we had paid for college. We were done. You know, that's usually the big, you know, the biggest bills you ever see in your life and all of those kinds of things. You know, we did that. So he kind of said, well, you know, why don't you think about something that might be more interesting to you? And at that time, I was actually involved with the business school at University of at Albany, which is, of course, where I'd gotten my degree. I had gotten involved in them with them while I was still working. And originally, a good friend of mine and I were the two women on the board of the business school. So that theme again.
Yeah.
And then we turned out to be two of the top five donors to the university for several years in a row. That theme again. But anyway, I was involved with my university. And also, I went to one of the special high schools here in New York City, which was just absolutely a life-changing and life-shaping experience for me. And I loved the place. So I had been involved with both of those organizations while I was working, and I really liked the work. I liked meeting the new people. And one of the things that I was concerned about when I left the bank, was the sort of social aspect. It's not that my husband and I don't get along and all of that sort of stuff, but, you know, we were both used to working in very large organizations where you interacted with a lot of people all the time. You didn't like everybody, but you liked some of them. And there was a sense that, you know, sort of kept you, the brain working and made, kept you vibrant and kind of focused and all of that. So the question was, how was I going to replace, if you will, the social dimension?
Yep.
You know, I wasn't going to make the same money. I got that. The good news is we saved a lot of money and invested wisely. But there's a social aspect. There's the kind of the keeping the brain alive aspect. There are these other parts to the good things about
feeling
working.
Feeling purposeful. Yeah. Feeling like purposeful, you have a reason.
Yeah, exactly. Which is a word that we use now, not as much back then. But you're absolutely right. And so in trying to figure that out, I sort of used the two organizations, which were obviously that I had benefited from personally greatly, as a little bit of a stepping stone and kind of a jumping off point to get more into the world of philanthropy. I actually did take a job. The pay was you know, nothing. But it was a job which forced, for those of us who've worked, you know, there's a structure to work and to the sense that you report to somebody, you're answerable, deadlines, all of those kinds of things. You know, you have to be more professional, knowledgeable. It's not the same as kind of being a volunteer and saying, hey, well, you know, whatever I do, you know, that's terrific. And so it gave me a little bit more grounding and a little bit more shape around work in the nonprofit world. I will say that it left me with the idea that there is a tremendous amount from the world of business that actually is really relevant to the nonprofit world, which I think people are more accepting of now. But I'm back, you know, 20 years ago, roughly. And I don't think all of the people in all of the organizations I spoke to at the time necessarily always felt that way. There is a can-do sense. There is a sense of, you know, a need for a certain amount of efficiency, personally, whatever your company may be doing. You know, there are some, you know, kind of skills and kind of a sense of, again, purpose and kind of, you know, the forward motion that's required. That is, you know, sometimes at odds with the sense of that a lot of younger people I have seen in philanthropy, where, you know, the idea is they're attached to the mission, and I'm attached to the missions for the organizations I serve as well. But the question is, how do you add, you know, the concept of adding value? How do you help them to move forward? How do you help them sometimes to grow, sometimes to stabilize, whatever it may be? That I think comes very much, you know, from a business perspective. So I've tried to bring that to the nonprofit work that I've done. So with the exception of this little job that sort of that got me started and got me a little bit more professionalized, all of what I've done since actually has been volunteering of one kind or another. And so it does mean that I get to pick and choose a little bit. And it means, which is quite different from work, and I actually really liked my jobs. But what is different is the sense of mission somehow is more front and center. You're not going to be happy, you know, volunteering for a nonprofit if you don't think that the work that they do is really important. It just doesn't, you know, you can work for a company where you don't think that they're going to save the world. And occasionally,
because they're getting money.
And occasionally when I worked at Chemical Bank, and, you know, the banks were kind of in the crosshairs of everybody at various points for various kinds of loans that they made or that failed or whatever was going on. And usually I was in the middle with the accounting trying to, you know, sort it out for them. But every once in a while, I would explain to somebody who didn't know me what I, you know, kind of did for a living, and they would shake their head and they would say, you know, you're not saving the world. And, you know, it sounds like you're, what I read in the paper is that your bank is a mess, Joan. And the bank,
what are you doing, Joan?
And with all due respect, I think it's really thriving without me. So, you know, I'm not worried about the bank here, but it just was, it was that kind of feedback, you know. The good news, I guess, about volunteering is you don't get that kind of feedback. Most people will think you are trying to save the world, and they'll be very respectful of it. So, you know, again, more interesting, you know, experiences in dealing with people. But anyway, if I could, you've mentioned the four organizations that I'm involved with, and if I could just do, it will sound like a bit of a plug, but just to talk a little bit about some of the work that they do and why it's interesting to me, I think it may be helpful.
Sure. Yeah, that's fine. Go
just
for it.
Just taking it sort of in order. Bronx Works has so many programs that we all can't count them. It's an organization that now has 900 people who work for it. There is that much work to do. And they are all immensely dedicated and very thoughtful. They are based primarily in the South Bronx. They have a number of locations. And they serve, the way I describe them, is that they serve everyone from the age of 3 to 103. We have programs to help immigrant families acclimate the parents as well as the child, so the child is ready to go to preschool or to kindergarten. And at the other end, at 103, there is a really very highly regarded senior anti-eviction program that tries very hard in the court system in the Bronx to help older people who very often landlords try to push out, quite frankly. And obviously money and all of those things are a challenge for them. And so there's a very highly regarded program that literally focuses on trying to save seniors from being, you know, pushed out onto the street. And there are programs to help other people with eviction, but in particular, you know, that's kind of the 103. They have wonderful senior centers. They have wonderful after-school programs where children can safely come and learn about nutrition, have a place to do their homework, all kinds of things like that.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful program that helps families and kids navigate middle school in New York City, which is quite complex, by the way. It can look at times like you're trying to apply to Harvard, only, you know, your child is 11 years old.
Wow.
Take a test. You have to say which school you prefer. It's kind of nuts. But this program tries to help the parents and the child through the process and then through high school. And then there's an excellent program to help these same kids and other kids figure out how to apply to college and what college is right for them, you know, financial aid, all these things that are not easy for anybody to navigate, but particularly if you're talking about people where the child is going to be the first person to go to college, where their families are immigrant families, you know, it's really a big deal. And the programs are outstanding. So that's Bronx Works. Friends of the Children is the opposite. Friends of the Children is a very focused, much smaller program that seeks children who are already struggling when they're in kindergarten. So this is at age 5. Sometimes they're not going to school because they have to babysit their younger siblings. These are age 5 children.
Yeah.
Sometimes their parents just haven't signed them up for school. Sometimes they don't know what school is. So they don't know what they're supposed to do with a pencil. It's a pretty wide, you know, language, all kinds of barriers. Sometimes these kids, by the way, need glasses. And of course, you know, they don't know it. And the idea is to take on some of these children, to pair them with a professional whom we call a friend, hence Friends of the Children, but who really is a professional who works with the child one-on-one, 4 hours a week. And the commitment is to work with the child to get them through high school with a plan. So it's 12 years plus. I've never heard of another program like that that will commit to you for 12 years.
Wow.
All the ups and downs, you know, that some of these families experience. So that's kind of, you know, instead of the very big and, you know, number of people that are 64,000 people a year are served at Bronx Works, this is, you know, we have something like 250 kids and their families at Friends of the Children New York. Workforce Professionals Training Institute. The thing that's interesting about New York City, and I don't know about Chicago or other cities, is that there really is no central government agency or one central kind of guru, if you will, about job training, job application, and how to bring people without an educational background or and without the network that most of us have had, how to bring them into the workforce, how to train them, how to match them with what employers actually really need. And of course, these days, even to work at Amazon, which is considered, you know, kind of entry-level work, you need to know something about technology, you have to be able to use a smartphone, you know, these kinds of things. And so so that's the challenge that they try to address. So very much aimed at immigrants and the underserved in New York. And I've left for last, because I think it goes back to the women theme, WellMet Philanthropy, which is a women's giving circle.
This I'm most interested in, by the way. I mean, all of what you're doing is incredible and I think is going to be really inspiring for my listeners who are approaching retirement or maybe in retirement and want to do things that are just more juicy in their lives. But this is it. So listen up to this.
This is fun. I mean, this is fun. And most of the women who are participating, and we have 36 members, think it's fun, you know, and interesting and worthwhile. We have a couple of women who've written to me to say they really have no time this year, but they're giving their dues anyway because they trust all of us to, you know, use them wisely.
So tell us
great work.
Yeah. So tell us how it works. It's a women's giving circle.
So just to step back and to think about the United States for a minute, not just my particular women's giving circle, it turns out, and this is fascinating to me, that giving circles are the fastest growing means for significant numbers of women to get involved in philanthropy in the United States. This is a trend for the last 25 or 30 years. So that's interesting in and of itself.
It is.
I think speaks to one of the things I love about WellMet, which is not simply the good work, although it is good work, but this sense of kind of comradeship and camaraderie, so that you have women who care about New York, care about these issues, and they band together. You know, they don't have to be your best friend, although some of them have made, you know, friendships now for some of the women who started years ago. You know, they're pretty tight now and they've worked together for many years. But everyone is interesting. Everyone is smart. People have worked in all sorts of other walks of life, like me, who certainly was not working. Nobody thinks working for a bank unless you're in the foundation is particularly philanthropic, as I shared earlier. Nobody thinks you're going to save the world. Some of these women do work in work in the nonprofit world, you know, for, you know, that's their professional life, but many of them didn't. A few were journalists. A number were financial executives like me. Some were teachers. Some used teaching or psychology as a springboard to get involved in a variety of administrative and executive roles to help other nonprofits. There's kind of a pretty broad range, and that makes it very interesting.
So tell us how it works. Do you meet monthly?
We meet only four times a year.
Oh, okay.
There are committees. So if you want to do more, I do more, obviously. Some others, women do too. There are committees to advance some of the actual grant making. And I do kind of this year, actually, I'm president. So I'm kind of, making sure all the wheels are turning, which, is very much a carryover from my professional life. And so I feel that's something, I can bring to the table. But basically the way it works is each of us kick in some money. In the United States, generally, usually those are relatively small amounts of money. And so you have very large groups of women, 100 women, 200 women. The way we think about it in New York and my particular organization is everybody does normally want to get their hands dirty. Mm-hmm. They want to actually do something. They want to see these organizations. They want to get out there. They want to get on the subway now that the pandemic is over. And so if you have 100 women, you can't all, do that.
Right.
But if you have, as we do, 36 women, we'd like to be a little bit bigger. So if anybody is listening from New York and you're interested, Kara knows where to find me. We'd like to be a little bit bigger, but with 36 women, you can have groups who go on site visits. You can have groups who reach out to some of these organizations and ask them for some, kind of basic information. What would you do if we gave you a grant? How do you work? Who are volunteers? Who else is funding you? A lot of pretty basic kinds of questions.
Yeah.
And then we meet four times a year and we advance. First, we start out by asking for nominees, which each of us are supposed to, if we have somebody right. worthy, mm-hmm. we share it with the group. Then we do a little bit of homework. And then we say, well, we really like these groups. We want to pursue it. So we ask them for something in writing with some of these, to respond to some of these questions that we have each year. Then we decide out of those people who still sounds interesting, and we decide we want to do a site visit. So we band together in a little group. Somebody kind of organizes us. Again, another volunteer who's doing work on a committee. And we all go out or we do it virtually, depends mm-hmm. on your schedule. You get to pick. And then based on the site visits, we get together at the beginning of June and we decide on grants. We decide on who and how much. We have some guidelines. The largest grant is $25,000, but it can't be more than a certain percentage of the budget. We don't want them to feel that it's,
yeah.
they have to have other funding beside us. Otherwise, the model doesn't work. So yeah. we have, rules of the road. And so each year for about 8 months, from the fall through to, say the first week in June, we work on, helping these organizations, and we stay in touch with organizations that were funded in the past. I just organized what we call an education session, where I reached out to four past grantees who work in the criminal justice space in different parts of the city and in slightly different ways. Each organization is a little bit different. And we had a panel and we asked them to talk about, you know, the work that they do. What are their biggest challenges other than money? You know, money's always going to be the first answer, right?
So right.
To be a little more creative. And it was a terrific conversation and people asked really good questions and a lot of information emerged. So we may do something like that again in a different field or maybe another one in criminal justice. You know, the group gets to, you know, kind of, you know, bring ideas forward and then we talk about it as a group at our meetings. And so it's really, you learn a lot and you know that you're doing something that, I mean, some of these grantees had grants before the recession, you know, so it goes back almost 20 years and they still remember that we gave them a shot when they were, you know, pretty yeah. young. And that helped them, you know, to get other grants and it, yeah. you know, sort of a ladder from there. And it's really actually quite nice to see that some of the organizations that these women were smart enough to bet on, if you want to put it that way, back in the day, yeah. have really materialized. So it's both fun. It certainly answers some of the social.
Yes.
And everybody, we meet in people's homes. I did the last one and put out, you know, a lot of cookies. The cookies actually go, I've noticed, a little bit of wine and, you know, a cheese plate. And it's, so it's not, you know, nobody's going to whip something up in the kitchen. And people are sort of grateful for a little bit of that to go on. And it was very interesting because I happened to host it this time. It's the first time I've been the host. My husband was here and he stayed in the back out of the way, but he could hear, couldn't hear actually what people said, but he was really impressed at how into it everybody was.
Wow. Really engaged.
Organization. I mean, he could hear all of a sudden that they're, just by the tone of voice, really, he yeah. could hear there were questions, comments, you know, things like that. He was fascinated. You know, he's seen some of the other organizations because they have big, you know, fundraising events and things yeah. like that. He's been very good about going. But he thought this was pretty interesting, and it is, because people get into it.
Yeah, well, I find the whole concept, as you mentioned, it's social, you're finding new friendships, you're being intellectually stimulated, and you're doing good in the world, both with your time and your money. And before I publish this episode, I'm going to do some research on women's giving circles and try to add some more resources in terms of, like, you know, where they are in major cities and where to find them. And people can certainly do that research on their own. But I just think that it checks so many boxes, as you mentioned. Yeah. And that's very, very cool.
It has just been, as I said, it has been fun. I keep repeating myself, but also very worthwhile. And we do have a major foundation in New York, New York Community Trust, who's kind of our back office. And that's how we get a tax deduction because we, you know, we give our funds to them and they hold it for us and they disperse it for
okay.
us. We give direction. So we're actually a donor advised fund, technically, for those who get into
yeah. you know, how all the
tax,
details,
tax
yeah.
deduction piece of that works.
Wow.
But the thing is, they also, first of all, there are a lot of the organization is actually run by women now. So they are, you know, paying attention. And they like the model too, because while our in New York, the contribution is $5,100. So, you know, it's not insignificant
yeah.
For people. At the same time, we have over $200,000 to disperse this year. You know, the power of that is much greater than that of what one individual can do with $5,100.
Yeah. yeah.
And you don't have some of the fiduciary responsibilities of being on a board, although I like that too, actually. So for a lot of people, if you don't have a lot of time, if you want to spread out some of the work that you want to support and not just do one board, a lot of our members are on, you know, boards as well and things, mm-hmm. It checks those boxes as well. And it can introduce you if you take advantage of some of the other women and New York Community Trust. And most cities have an equivalent of the New York Community Trust. There's a
yes.
Rhode Island Foundation.
They have Chicago Community Trust. Yeah.
Things in the Northeast. You know, you can be introduced to other organizations that do terrific work that are, you know, that are interesting to you. One of the things that's going on in New York, and my guess would be in Chicago also, is, of course, we have all these asylum seekers.
Yes.
City, and I don't want to get into the politics of all of that and the buses that come in and this kind of thing. But both New York Community Trust and WellMet, you know, that's we've had people come to talk to us about it. It's a topic that's of interest. Mm-hmm. WellMet has in the past funded a number of organizations who help with the legal side of immigration, who help Custom Collaborative, which teaches mostly women immigrants how to sew and how to, you know, make garments and do that piece of, you know, the industry here in New York.
Yeah.
Emma's Torch, restaurant work, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of things that have been sort of aimed at the, they also funded Safe Passage very early in its day, which has done tremendous legal work to help on immigration issues and to particularly help children who come as immigrants. It also allows you to get a window into issues that concern many of us,
yeah.
to learn a little bit more about them and to find out that really sometimes we don't know it. You know, the newspapers are full of the things they think are, you know, of the moment. But there are 8.5 million people in this city. And of course, yeah. a lot of them are immigrants, but a lot of them are also people who are, you know, tackling some of this work. So it's really, it's fascinating from that point of view.
Yeah. Finally, I go back to what advice you have for people who are transitioning into their third act.
So I do have a couple of ideas that I did want to share. One thing is the way I was connected to Bronx Works is that I went to a foundation, and in the case in New York, it's Robin Hood, and there's not really exactly a Robin Hood in other cities, as I understand it. But I went to an organization that funds many small nonprofits here in the city, particularly mm-hmm. interested in education and work, those same themes again. Mm-hmm. And they knew me from one of the organizations. They funded Friends of the Children New York for a long time, so they knew me. I'd been the board chair for many years. And I went to them and they did matchmaking for me.
Oh, nice.
And so, you know, it's a big city. So the question is, you know, so they really did a little job interview. You know, I gave them a resume. They asked me questions about my resume. And they gave me a choice of 5 organizations. And they all looked pretty good. And I was, frankly, kind of a little overwhelmed. And I went back to them and said, well, where do you think I could do the most good? And they sit in the Bronx and with Bronx Works. And so that's how that happened. There are some online services, BoardSource, BoardStrong. Most of these are .orgs.
Okay.
People can do a Google. There's one that serves African-American organizations in particular. I think I actually have a list somewhere. I might be able to email that to you if I can find the list.
Sure.
There are a number of ways that you can kind of find a matchmaker, and obviously your own friends and your own family circle and things like that are tremendously important. I got involved with Friends of the Children New York because one of my childhood friends from first grade, her wife actually knew about Friends of the Children, you know, kind of from the beginning. And when I told my childhood friend that I was, you know, looking for some, you know, I was going to transition away from work. I was looking for some meaningful things to do. She went to her wife and they said, oh, we have to tell you about Friends of the Children New York. And so, you know, 18 years later, here I am. Mm-hmm. So obviously, you know, friends, family, colleagues, all of those things.
Yeah.
For those who are still working, and particularly if you're working in a large corporation or uh-huh. organization, usually there's somebody who either in HR or a separate department is called corporate social responsibility, CSR. There are different names, but that will kind of get you going most of the time. You can go talk to them. Many large companies, including mine, actually will give very small amounts of money. You know, my company did $1,000 a couple times for me to encourage people to join boards
Yeah.
and to get involved in the community. So it's really more about volunteering, not necessarily that you have to be on the board. So that's a way both to get connected to organizations. And if you're interested in supporting an organization, by the way, go put your organization on their list, because usually that will make you make them actually eligible for matching gifts.
Ah, nice.
You know, so,
yeah.
So those kinds of departments can be very helpful, both, you know, in both dimensions.
Yeah.
There is an overarching major organization that's kind of the umbrella organization of women's giving circles, and that is Philanos, which is Philanos.
Okay.
It's philanos.org, I believe. And they have, actually, WOMED has decided not to stay with them, but generally speaking, they have many of the organizations. They were founded on the West Coast, and they have many of the giving circles all over the United States. So that's an easy way if you particularly want a giving circle and you want to get started. You know, that's a particularly good way to help find somebody, you know, reach out to if you don't, you know, have a personal or another contact. So those would be some ways that, you know, you can get started. And most of these organizations also do some training for those who want to be on a board. They'll kind of do a little bit of a, I wouldn't say it's nonprofit finance for dummies, because I don't think any of these folks are dumb, but it's a little bit like that in the sense that it's a sort of a 101. It's not, you know, I was a financial executive, obviously, but you don't have to be.
Yeah.
It is useful to understand a little bit how the finances work.
Yes.
And what some of the issues are and what some of the pitfalls are, because they do come up.
Yeah.
People always want to buy a building, and I would tell you financially not such a great idea and things like that. So, you know, also going to some of these courses, you'll hear about organizations, but also you'll feel that you are a little bit more prepared sometimes for some of these jobs if that's not your, you know, your background.
Yep.
I will say that most of the organizations I'm involved with have a lot of lawyers. So those folks are always prepared.
Yes.
Always seem to know what's going on, but, you know, not everybody's a lawyer or wants to be one. So those would be a few suggestions that I have, to do some of the initial legwork to figure out what might suit you. But the most important thing is to figure out what you're interested in.
I decided
I'm interested in New York City. Mm-hmm. There's a world where so many people need help, you know.
Yeah.
I know a number of people who are dedicated to organizations that help people in Haiti and, you know, and all kinds of things. So it isn't that, you know, that's the only choice or the best choice. It's really what is the match for you. In my case, as I said, New York City, education, social services. I will tell you, honestly, I have a friend who's a big wheel in the art world. She was a very senior lawyer and super smart, and has been collecting art really her whole adult life. So it's a really interesting story that way. But in New York, as you might imagine, there are a lot of very large and very rich arts organizations.
Yes.
And there isn't, you know, and it's fine to be a member and things like that, but I don't have, you know, the funds to be able to kind of, you know, be in that wheelhouse. So the question is, what was the right match, not only for my interests, but also, frankly, for my pocketbook? And it's important for people to think about that. This is, you know, it's not a faint of wallet exercise usually. When people volunteer, you know, sometimes people are delighted to have your sweat equity. But usually if they have your sweat equity, they will also ask you for funds. And
that's
obviously each of us, you know, anybody who does want to join a board should always ask what the give and get is. Because, you know, because that's important. No.
Yeah. You're on lock for it.
I mean, if you have a network who, you know, will help, you know, support you and give, maybe then you can be more aspirational about joining an organization, that's, you know, larger and asks for more money. But those are, you know, those are things to think about so that you feel that you're doing something good instead of that you're, you know, you're straining your budget.
Yeah, no, for sure. Has to be a good match. Well, Joan, you have been a fountain of amazing information for retired women and, frankly, men as well. And I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
One last thing. I do want to tell you, except for the Women's Giving Circle, which, of course, is by definition all women.
Yes.
My other organizations have a lot of guys, and it's just terrific.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it's, you know, they have a lot to bring to the table, too. So,
of course,
you know, it's good to have the mix, too.
Yes. Okay.
Having talked about, you know, women's giving circles for, you know, 15 minutes or something.
That's okay. It's where my passion lies. Thank you, Joan.
So it's just been delightful to talk to you and to get to know you just a little bit through these conversations.
Likewise. Thanks so much, Joan.
Thank you, and take care.
This podcast is sponsored by Good Morning Freedom, my retirement coaching firm. I help executives and professionals plan the non-financial part of their retirement, like how to discover new purpose and how you want to spend your time. I offer a one-on-one coaching retirement blueprint package where we work together to discover some new avenues of exploration for your Act 3. This coaching is completely custom and will provide you with a ton of resources and support as you transition to this new stage of life. For all the details, please go to goodmorningfreedom.com/services.